You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, let me go ahead and set the stage for you guys. Today on the show, we're going to be talking with Jay from Fire Drill Podcast. And it's criminal to try to shorten all this, but let me just give you the short and sweet, the TLDR. Jay has moved to three states in the past 3 years in the pursuit of financial independence, career hacking like a pro, taking her income from 33K to well over 100K, and then double that within 5 years through mercenary salary negotiation, which she likes to say she won 3 out of 4 times. This is going to be an incredibly actionable episode where we're going to dive into how a female is able to graduate with a poli-sci degree and then somehow leverage that into the highly competitive tech world through the art of career hacking. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing well. The way you set that up, I just cannot wait for this conversation. I mean, Jay has a little bit of everything in her story. Frankly, I could have used her negotiating skills. That was something I was woefully unprepared for in my own life. And hopefully she can pass on some really concrete and actionable tips to the audience. So with that, Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jay, this episode is going to be all about career hacking. It is not going to be about college hacking because I don't think that your optimal self really started firing on all cylinders until after you graduated and realized you didn't know what to do with your degree. Am I right about that?
No, exactly. I mean, I thought I did everything right. I got about $17,000 worth of scholarships, so I applied to as many as I could. But after hearing your interview with Travis, I realized that I probably made the wrong decision with college choice. I went for prestige and the best school I could possibly get into and not the one that makes the most sense from an ROI perspective.
Jay, were any of the other colleges that you gained acceptance to, did you have better financial aid packages or merit scholarships?
I only applied to one, and I could have went to the state school in my state, and I chose not to do that because I thought that I would get into this great school, which I did. So my mind wasn't even there. And I remember I had friends who made the decision. One of my friends turned down an Ivy League school, and I just didn't understand why she did that. And now I totally get it.
And I know, Brad, that you have a similar story where you kind of had your pick of colleges and you made kind of a more mercenary approach to do the one that is going to have the lower cost. And I think even if you were going to say that you were being suboptimal in other ways, you look back at that choice and you say that really did make a difference on your outcome.
Yeah, it definitely did. But unfortunately, I didn't even go as far as, like you said, Jay, Travis. That was an amazing story and made me just feel terrible about myself and the decisions that I made. But I have to say, still, the $17,000 in scholarships that you earned, that's pretty impressive in and of itself. Like, how did you go about that? Do you recollect?
I went for mostly local scholarships. And part of it was growing up in an affluent town where I wasn't as affluent as the other people. So in high school, from a need perspective, I met the eligibility for the scholarships, but I was at the same place school-wise, academic-wise as my friends. So I think I was just more competitive for some of these scholarships.
Well, talk us through your strategy here. So you're graduating, you know, you're a senior in college, you're graduating, and you chose poli-sci as a major. But I know that right now you're working in the tech industry. So what's the thought process here? Are you gonna change the world through liberal arts? What's the plan?
I had no plan going into college. I took whatever class I wanted to take. I started out thinking that I would be a biology major and I would be a doctor. And then I changed my mind about 5 core classes in, decided that I loved learning about international relationships. And I think really it stemmed to wanting to travel. I didn't travel very extensively growing up. So when I had the opportunity to study abroad when I was in college, that completely changed my perspective. And I thought I wanted to major in that because everyone gives you the advice, well, you should major in your passion. And it wasn't until after college that I regretted that.
So talk us through this. You graduate college and you now have this poli-sci degree. That how much student loan debt did you take on for this?
I had about 25K.
Okay. All right. Not too bad. So you graduate and are the jobs just waiting for you?
No. And I was very aggressive about applying to jobs, but And I had internships and I had good grades. So I kind of had the whole package. I was a college athlete. So I thought this should be easy. And it wasn't easy for me. I mean, graduating in 2011, it wasn't 2009, but it wasn't much better. And it was very hard. I remember I had a lot of friends who were unemployed at the time, too. And we were just racking our brains, applying to every job that we could possibly apply to. And some point in the middle of the summer after I graduated, that's when the light bulb went off. And I realized I'm not going to wait around for something good to happen to me and me just to get lucky. I need to just start taking action. And I sort of changed my whole trajectory right there.
Yeah, I was thinking the other option is you could just go back to school, right? That's the key card that everybody else seems to have. Oh, we'll just do two more years. I think we need our master's. That's when we were eligible to get our first job.
Yep, I definitely had friends who went that option. And I mean, for some of them, that was a great choice. But for me personally, especially coming out with student loan debt, I wasn't ready to go right back to school.
Let's talk about taking action. Like, what does that mean for you? You're a poli sci major and there's no jobs available for poli sci majors, at least, you know, in your small world at this particular point in time, nobody is knocking on your door asking you, what does taking action actually look like?
So my friends and I, we would go to Starbucks, the unemployed friends, and we would apply to jobs all day. And we would drink expensive lattes, which we couldn't afford. I think I had $100 left in my bank account at the time. And they were telling me that they were starting WordPress blogs about their lives. And my life was very boring at the time. So the idea of writing about it every day just sounded awful. So I created a blog about study abroad because that was my passion. And I got so into it. I mean, I was doing this night and day. And from there, it ended up opening up doors for me because a student travel startup found my blog and asked me for an informational interview so they could understand the student travel online space. And then after that, I was so passionate about it. They invited me to work for them for free. And I did that for 2 years. So that kind of helped me move forward and start creating. And then on the personal front, I decided to take action by volunteering more at my local library. But before this, I was always a joiner. I had joined sports teams. I joined volunteer groups. I joined classes and communities at school, but I had never created anything in my life. So I went into the library and I don't know what made me do this at all. I just decided I need to do something. So I went to the librarian and asked her, can I start a gifted and talented program at the library for third graders? That was something that I did growing up. I did a gifted and talented program and I thought it was an awesome experience. And I look back fondly on it. So I decided, why couldn't I go give back and teach right now? I'm not employed. This would be a great time to do that. So I advertised in the local library newsletter and the first week, one kid showed up. And I was so embarrassed. I made this big deal about it and I tried to get a friend to do it with me and I felt like I had failed. But the second week, that one kid and his mom told all of their friends, and parents are so competitive, that I had a class of 10 students there for the Gifted and Talented program. And between that and then the study abroad experience, I ended up putting those things on my resume and I became this person who just creates things and doesn't just join things that other people have created.
Wow. I became a person who creates things. What an interesting statement. I love that. I mean, who gave you permission, right? Like, I think that's what so many people get held back by. Where did you have the audacity to start this gifted and talented program? So many people would say, oh, but I'm not an educator. Oh, but I'm not this. I'm not that. Where will I get the space? Will anybody show up? Do you remember what you were thinking at the time? Like, that is so impressive. I just love for you to put yourself back at that time period and just think through, how did you have the guts to do that?
I think truly that I had hit rock bottom. And it was a really hard identity shift for me because I am someone that I got all these scholarships. I went to a great school. I got good grades. I was a college athlete. I studied abroad. I did everything. I did internships. I did everything I thought right. So to be in that position after school, it was just frankly embarrassing. I mean, I was embarrassed about the situation I was in. I was living back with my parents. I love my parents. They're amazing. And I'm lucky to have that opportunity, but it wasn't where I wanted to be at the time. So I think for me, I hit rock bottom. And I actually remember in my very juvenile sense what that moment was. I went out to a bar in Boston with my friends and I went to order a very crappy $5 rum and Coke and my cart declined. That was like the real low point. Like, who are you? What are you doing with your life? And from there, I started moving.
That's amazing. So, I mean, today you are a financial independence podcaster of great renown. And a handful of years ago, a $5 charge got declined. That is incredible. I mean, have you ever reflected on what an incredible journey that is?
Honestly, sometimes I think about how the past decade has been. And I mean, it's been 7 years since I graduated from college. And Yeah, I am impressed. I mean, it's cool. I don't mean to say this to be cocky in any way, but I kind of became the person that I wanted to be and didn't know how to be, if that makes sense. Like, I think 21-year-old me would be like, high five. I'm so glad that this happened for us, you know? Does that sound weird? I don't know.
No, that's amazing. That's amazing. How would someone else become the person they wanted to be? I mean, really, and I say that with sincerity, could you help somebody else do that? Like, I'm sure there are so many people out there that have hit that rock bottom and would desperately want to take action, but they're too scared. What do you tell that person?
First thing is that you just have to do it. And I understand the scared part. It's not like I'm not scared. And, you know, the embarrassment and putting yourself out there, you may think it's weird, like, especially, you know, being 21 years old, you're very worried about being weird and what other people think, at least I was. So strolling into the library saying like, hey, can I work with kids and start this program? I just felt like, who does that? Why should I do this? But you just got to push past it. And once you do it once, do something really small, it just builds on itself. And you just can't wait for the opportunity to come to you. If you want an opportunity or you feel like you deserve an opportunity, you got to make it for yourself.
I just want to set the frame that, you know, very much what we're going to be following you, kind of, we're following you on this journey right now. And your journey is that of, what have you created? What have you built, right? That's just a theme that I think you'll see over and over again. But I want to go back to this gifted and talented class that you set up for these kids at the library. What was that? I mean, what were you doing? What were you offering for them? Was this, you're teaching them how to do math? This is an extra school session. You said that this left this kind of warm feeling when you participated in something similar as a child. So this isn't a Jay original. This is something that you saw. It was valuable. And then you iterated it and you made it your own for the purposes of sharing it with these kids. Like, walk us through that. What service were you actually offering?
Yes. Yeah, so I knew there was a need in the community. The woman who used to run the program, she had retired pretty soon before I did this. So I knew that this wasn't being offered anymore in the community and that people would be probably interested in doing it. I remember growing up, some of the things we did code breaking, for example, like the wingdings you see on Microsoft Word, we could get an entire page full of code and then we could figure out what the sentences were. And I don't mean code in the way that, you know, we're talking about coding in tech. I'm talking about like truly codes, like code breaking, right? And things like that.
An Enigma machine type code.
Yes. Method. Yes. Like, yeah. Little things like that. Or fun challenges where you had to build, whoever built the tallest tower out of marshmallows using only like 3 toothpicks or whatever, these little challenges that kind of spur your brain and creativity. When you're little, you have that ability. And it's funny, when I was, my friend and I ended up doing it with a friend. And I would recommend to anyone who's nervous about doing this yourself, it's okay to start it with a friend at first. I didn't really get comfortable doing solo things until later. It took me to have a buddy to do it with. But the two of us, we would look at some of the codes that the third graders were doing. And when I ultimately did get a job, I got a job in the period of this time. I remember sometimes I wouldn't have time before work to like really code break myself. And they're hard. Doing them as an adult, I don't know if you have the same creative brain that you did when you were in third grade. I mean, I was so impressed by these kids.
So Jay, I wanted to just talk quickly about 2 years of working for free for this travel site or travel company. What does your financial life look like at this point? So you're teaching a gifted and talented program and you're working for free. Are you still living with your parents at that point? How are you earning even like tiny little bits of money just to even pay for coffee or anything? Like, what does your financial life look like at that point?
So I pivoted to apply to different types of jobs than I would previously. And I'm kind of mad at myself for not considering these jobs when I first graduated from college. Because when I first graduated from college, I had friends that they were working at Goldman Sachs. And actually, I had an interview there and I didn't get in. I was very devastated by that. And I was only looking for these prestigious, kind of right out of school, the job that would pay, you know, at least $60,000 a year, whatever. And by July, after I graduated, I realized, you know what, this isn't happening for me. I need to pivot and I want to take any job I possibly can. And I'm not going to be snooty about it. I'm just going to take a job. So I got a legal assistant job, which at that time I already decided I didn't want to go to law school, but I needed money. I needed a job. I just needed to get some experience and get my foot in the door. So I was doing that at the time. And I think my savings rate was like off the charts. I can't get into my Bank of America account at the time to figure out what it was, but I think it was like 95% or something. I didn't know about FI or anything. I just had really low expenses. I was living with my parents and I just decided, you know, to bank as much money as I can so I could save for something bigger.
So there was some aspect of intentionality. It wasn't FI intentionality, but you were saving for a purpose. It wasn't just willy-nilly, oh, let's save some money. There was a greater purpose to that.
I've never been a saver, but, you know, I had a comfortable upbringing, but I wouldn't say I had a great amount of financial means. It's not like my parents. Let's say I decided to move and move to a different city. It's not like, oh, here's, you know, $2,000 so you can put a down payment or get a deposit for your rent and so you can get furniture. It wasn't like that. So I knew if I wanted that, I had to save up for it. So I did.
All right. So this is your first real paying job at this particular point in time, and you're making roughly around $30,000 a year. Is that close?
I actually started making $40,000, but later I made $30,000. So I went down before I went up.
Oh,
but
that's
I was doing
this,
and then I was working for the startup at night on top of doing the legal assistant job.
I just want to track this because your trajectory, which we'll cover, is shocking. And there's so many people that got degrees that aren't serving them and want to transition or want to pivot, but think they can't because they can't go back and redo their early teens. I don't want to gloss over anything. I want to capture every single step as we go, but I think it starts with this. So this first job that you got, when you got out of school, you have this poli sci degree, a bachelor's poli sci degree. You're applying for all the jobs that everybody wants that you can expect to, in theory, you could get with that degree. So $60,000 a year, that's what you're shooting for. All of them rejected you or didn't return your phone call or didn't give you the interview. So you lowered the bar and you started applying for anything that would take you. But this is still tangentially related to your degree in terms of how you would stack your resume. When you're applying for this job, you would say, hey, by the way, I'm a poli sci major. This legal assistant job would be a good fit. And you got the interview, right?
Yes. And I mean, I had to tell the story of, you know, look at my background. This is a good fit. I'm ultimately going to law school, which at the time I knew I wasn't doing that, but I just needed the job. So I would recommend to anybody, you know, if you want to go down one avenue, sometimes you may get there through a convoluted route. You can't go straight there.
Yeah. Don't necessarily tell them that you're pursuing early retirement. Don't lead with that.
Definitely not.
All right, let's go a little deeper here. So I know that your story doesn't finish with you being a legal assistant. Like, what is your next transition? So you're a legal assistant that has also built a website and done some volunteer work with a company that has some similar related interest. You also have this gifted and talented program that you've put together. What comes next?
So based on those two experiences, I completely scrapped my college resume. I mean, I kept that I was in the Honor Society and all those things on there, but I added that I was working with a startup and I added the experience from the volunteer program. And then I started floating my resume out to other places. And one of the postings that I saw was an internship at the US Olympic Committee for someone to work in digital media. And the work that I was doing with the startup and with my own blog seemed to be a natural fit. So I applied and I ended up getting an interview and the job.
So I want to pause there, and I'm sure Brad wants to weigh in as well, but it sounds to me like for this setup, while I'm sure that somewhere on your resume you had listed that you were a poli sci major and that you were working as a legal assistant, that isn't the hook that got you past the gatekeeper in HR. It was that you had built this website, that you had this experience. It's things that you did without the permission of the 4-year college degree. Am I right about that?
Yes, I never would have gotten a phone call if I kept my original resume. It was all the stuff that I had built with the study abroad and the student travel.
And when did you actually decide to make that shift with the resume? That's like a very concrete thing, throwing away your old life in a sense, or, okay, that might not have worked, but here's what actually has worked. Like, I'm picturing this as this seminal moment. Did you really put a lot of thought into that? Like, okay, I'm really changing from here forward, or was it less monumental, I guess, than I'm picturing?
I would recommend someone to be more thoughtful about it. But at the time, this all happened naturally. It was just a sequence of things.
So I'm looking at my quick sheet here, and I believe just based on the timeline that you sent me, this is roughly 2013. And you just got this, I guess, internship at this Olympic training facility. So you've leveraged, you know, the what have you built model that we were just talking about, and you grab this internship. This has to be a pay cut though, right? You were a legal assistant making $40,000 a year. They surely weren't able to match that in an internship role.
No, it was $9 an hour.
So this nonlinear progression, I mean, we're moving forward. I mean, this story is leading to a really, really awesome place, but it doesn't always go straight up.
No, I believe in the Sheryl Sandberg approach to your career, that it should look like a jungle gym and not necessarily a straight ladder.
And even at the time when you're going to $40 to $9 an hour, do you feel confident about this?
No. I mean, I guess I still had big goals for myself, but the opportunity to move to Colorado and work at the Olympic Training Center was a very cool opportunity. And sometimes where you work is more important than what you get paid. So having that brand on my resume, anytime I go into an interview now, and I've since worked at some more big brand places, when you work at some of the best brands in the world, people are happy to talk about that experience in an interview, and it helps you later on. So I don't care if they paid me $5 an hour or $2 an hour, that experience was invaluable.
So how did you leverage your time at the Olympic Training Center for future jobs? Talk me through what you actually talked about in future job interviews or et cetera. As I understand it, you're a digital marketer for the Olympic Training Center or the U.S. Olympic Committee. I'm not sure precisely who it was, but talk me through what that practically looks like.
So at that time, because I had had experience with a startup and through creating my own blog, I could be more valuable to them than probably a traditional intern, because the traditional intern responsibilities, you were supposed to help fulfill sponsorship rights on social media for like Hilton and other companies that sponsor the Olympic Training Center. But I was very interested in their web analytics, and I had access to their Google Analytics, and I could see where people were coming from on the website, and I could help them meet their goals. I knew that they wanted to get to a certain goal. This was leading up to the London Olympic Games, which was a really cool time to be an intern there. But they really had this like traffic goal and all these things. And because I had my own experiences through the study abroad stuff, I was able to add more value to them. And I did outside projects that they didn't ask me to do. And I just made up, had meetings with my boss, like, hey, this is what I did this week. And I put a time on her calendar to discuss it. And we actually implemented it, and it resulted in like a 200% traffic increase or something crazy. So I started really changing how I operated in the workplace too.
Wow. So you're actually positioning yourself to bring, you know, what have you built type ideas to your boss. So instead of your boss giving you a task list and you checking off on it before you go home for the day, you're bringing them ideas. You're bringing them projects that you've done. And again, in your mind, it's twofold. One, it's obviously making you more valuable to the company that you're working with, but it's also adding to your own resume, because now your resume becomes a list of accomplishments, which are very tangible and will kind of propel you down this career hacking pipeline that we're talking about.
Yes. And I saw the result of it after 4 months into the 5 month internship. So on the US Olympic Committee front, that was the first intern to get a full-time offer. And then I actually technically had two, because some other people who were looking for someone who was post MBA to do some type of digital advertising position, they didn't know that I had just graduated college like a second ago because of some of the work that I was doing. And I had to be like, no, I don't have an MBA and I'm actually only 22 or something. So I didn't end up getting that job. But on the outside front, so I had even more stuff to put on my resume. And I actually had an interview with MTV for another internship in New York. So it was kind of cool. Like, I started getting bites when previously I didn't ever get any bites on my resume.
Olympic training facility. It's a really solid thing to have on a resume, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good brand and people enjoy talking about it.
So all of this is a background. I think our audience listening to this has a pretty good idea of what initially may have looked like a real setback, going from 40 down to $9 an hour, back up to 33. You know, that's a jungle gym. Some people would initially say, you're not really moving in the right direction there. But I think now, as we start to see some of these accomplishments, very quickly, your perspective changes and you're like, wow, this is really starting to come together. But how do you go from where you are now to the tech industry? What sequence of events gets us there?
I got a full-time offer in Colorado to continue working full-time for the US Olympic Committee. I worked for one of the sports that roll up into the Olympic Committee. And I had just had the interview with MTV, and actually the interview went really well. So I had no reason to think I wouldn't get the job. I probably had a good chance of getting it, but I met Doug, my husband, and he was planning on staying in Colorado after the internship ended. And I thought, this is a really great guy and I don't want to leave and miss this opportunity. We had just started dating like 3 months or something. And I knew that when you're 22 and you start dating someone, long distance is just not going to happen, at least for me. So I decided to stay in Colorado. I worked at the sport that rolls up into the Olympic Committee for about 10 months. It was a wonderful job and it was a great experience, but I knew that I had bigger goals for myself and I decided to apply to tech jobs. I had sort of got some experience through working for the startup, which by that time I had worked for it for 2 years and I was promised equity, but we never actually resulted. We'd applied to some startup incubators like Startup Chile and Y Combinator and we didn't get in. But I put that on my resume that I had worked for this startup and I had managed some of the website development. We had a $15,000 budget. So when I applied to my first job in tech, it wasn't at a tech company, but I had that small experience and that was enough to get me that first entry-level tech job.
There's something that comes to mind. And even though you said when it came to meeting Doug, you were not able to be mercenary in terms of choosing your living location. That was like at least one particular, you know, strand too far. And I think you made the right choice there. When it comes to jobs, I know that you are absolutely willing to, instead of just trying to beat your head against the wall, if you're bumping up against that ceiling, just take a horizontal lane and move next door to the competitor or move next door to someone else that maybe will give you more upward mobility. Is that how it works in the tech industry as well? Or was there basically you could do everything within one company?
I mean, if you are lucky enough to get an internship at Google straight out of school or during school and then get hired into a company like that, once you're in and you can ping pong around and do whatever you want. But to get in there, it can be really challenging and very competitive. So I had to sort of sidestep. So I applied to a financial services company and I worked in the tech, the IT department, and that gave me experience. And actually, I mean, I've worked in both technology companies and the financial services company. And I would say from a early 20s mentorship and career development perspective, that's the place to be. Because you have people that have been in their career for, you know, 40 something years. And at this point, they have a high level of respect in the organization. They have a lot of power. And what I've found is that they're very interested in taking these young people and teaching them everything they know and moving them up through the ladder. And I haven't seen that yet at a tech company. I think it moves too fast. And age-wise, they seem to be not quite as diverse.
So were you getting background info on financial services generally, or was this really just like the tech aspect of that particular company or profession?
I did. I had to learn some financial services things in order to succeed in the role. And at the time, I didn't really know about FI, but it was very helpful. And looking back on it, I know a lot of stuff about taxes and distribution and, you know, RMDs, for example, that most people don't know, but I learned through my job.
So looking at this kind of jungle gym type experience, like, is this the most direct path for someone that is trying to kind of do this dramatic pivot? I mean, is this basically what it looks like? Or looking back now, is there a more streamlined way to go about this?
There's definitely a more streamlined way. So I mentioned what helped me is that I had experience through the startup. Also, I got my master's online. I paid for it through employer reimbursement, which was a great perk of working where I worked. But now I would do it totally differently after working in tech. There are hackathons. I actually just went to a hackathon hosted at Facebook last weekend, and that can be a great way for someone who wants to get into tech to get tech experience. For example, at a hackathon, you go into teams and you work the whole weekend to build a project. And let's say that you're someone that has a skill set in a certain area, or you're just starting to learn like Python, for example, but you don't have mobile development skills. If you go to a hackathon, you can get the whole team there. You can get someone who can do mobile stuff. You can get someone who can do the UX. You can get a project manager who puts it all together, and you can actually come up with a finished result that you can put on your resume and walk away from that experience with. And when I talked to the other people who were at the hackathon, that's the reason they were doing it, because they wanted experience to put in their resume and ultimately get into one of these companies.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because that reminds me of a conversation we had with Ryan Carson from Treehouse, where basically he's looking at coding as a trade job and not something that you need a four-year degree or an advanced degree for. But it's actually like a proof is in the pudding type scenario where you're learning significant skills and then proving them by, I guess, putting your projects on, I think it was GitHub is what he said. And that reminds me of what you're talking about with the hackathon. Talk me through how that would work. Like, would you tell someone to get a four-year degree if they're looking to get into this world? Like, is that still valuable, or are going for these specific skills first better maybe?
I think at the same time, a lot of places still require a four-year degree to get in the door. Not every place does. So it depends on where you want to work. But these are great ways to distinguish yourself and prove that you have the skills. Exactly what you said, the proof is in the pudding. And I think that's how tech sort of works nowadays. So what I would do is I would search online for communities to get involved with, affinity groups, that's huge. The hackathon that I attended last weekend, it was for diversity and inclusion. So if you were in certain affinity groups, now you don't need to be in an affinity group. There's a million hackathons that don't have this. But, you know, if you are in an affinity group, there could be events in your local area that you could find out about. Eventbrite is another website that has information about it. Meetup, Facebook. So I'm someone that I join all of those communities. And when I see an opportunity like this, I jump on it. So after the hackathon, Facebook sent me an email saying, hey, would you like to work for us? You know, we saw you attended the hackathon, blah, 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 blah. So you can get on their recruiting list by attending free things like the hackathon too. I will say that I had to become the type of person who takes advantage of these opportunities and seeks them out, because previously I wasn't. Like I said, I joined things, but I wasn't trying to network. And actually, networking had kind of a negative connotation in my mind because I thought it meant that I was trying to be political, or I was trying to, you know, like, sometimes people don't really like the person that puts themselves out there like that. But if I had these certain goals, I had to force myself to do it. I have a post on my site that I call being a woo girl and why people like woo girls. And it's someone who's super friendly and really goes out of their way to meet people. I never used to like that type of person, like, because I thought they were being fake. But you can't make these connections if you don't put yourself out there to make the connections. And I would say 90% of the stuff I did to put myself out there didn't work. Like, I went to a million meetups. I joined Levo League, which is a women's kind of online group, and they have chapters across the country. And I went to a million of those meetups and they weren't successful. But I had a few things that worked out. So the bets, I took a bunch of bets and some of them really paid off.
Jay, you mentioned something called an affinity group. Can you explain that for our audience?
Sure. And this is kind of a controversial topic in tech, especially given the Google manifesto thing that was sent out. And I have a lot of formed opinions on it, just being a woman in tech. But there are opportunities for women, for people who identify as LGBTQ, for people who are Asian or Black or any other type of affinity group, to sort of network and form up with other people who identify in that affinity group or are allies of that affinity group, to get access to opportunities that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. Now, whenever I say something like that, usually one of my guy friends is like, how come I can't have that? It's like, well, because you get that every other day. Like, every other group is a men's group, okay? So let us just have this one. But, you know, if you are someone who can identify in one of those affinity groups, this is a way that you can kind of break through some of the barriers that you may see for yourself in an industry like technology, where it's very difficult to get ahead.
Were there any specific ways that the affinity groups have helped you directly? Like, can you point to one or two jobs or interviews that you got or connections or anything like that?
Sure. So my first one, the biggest one, I think, out of all of this for me, was going to the Grace Hopper celebration, which is a giant, one of the biggest celebrations in the world for women in technology. And I ended up getting a scholarship to that. So even though I was working full time and I had a good tech job, I had student loan debt. This is before I discovered FI. And I was getting my master's online at night. So I Googled women scholarships, because originally I was trying to get a scholarship to cover more of my master's program, even though a lot was already covered through my work. I was trying to completely eliminate the cost. And I ended up finding this conference, and they had a small amount of scholarships for people who were currently in graduate programs. They'd pay for you to go to the conference. And I knew, like, even though, you know, them paying for me to go to the conference, it wasn't that expensive of a conference per se, but I would be part of this group where companies would be looking, they're purposely recruiting because they're saying, like, oh crap, we need more women in technology positions. They would go to conferences like this to kind of scrape more names. So I knew if I was part of that special scholarship group, I would get an added boost, maybe an extra look at my resume, and every little bit helps in a very competitive industry like this. So I ended up doing the scholarship application, which was kind of awkward actually, because I was a young manager and I had to ask one of my direct reports to write a recommendation for me. Which any manager, like, even if you think you have people on your team that like you and support you, it's still kind of weird to put yourself out there like that. But I think especially my mid-20s, it was just like forcing myself to be uncomfortable and putting myself out there so that I could get ahead.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that if you had just stayed in your first job and tried to just earn your way and just stay in this one place and be the best employee that you could possibly be here, that was not going to allow you to double, triple, and multiples of your income. It was more that you were willing to change your geographic location, the entire field that you were in, and then you were willing to use some of these other actionable tips that you just talked about. That's what allowed you to multiply your income.
Yes, and in salary negotiation. So when I did that first leap, I was making $33,000, yet I asked for $65,000, which is like, who are you? You know, you don't have any experience. You only have like 2 years. You just graduated college 2 years ago and now you want to get paid this type thing. But I did my research and I got a good sense from the job that they were interested in, and I went for it. And I actually asked for 70, which is kind of crazy. But I have examples like that all through 5 years of my career where I just did it. And at this point, I have a strategy for negotiating my salary. I think it's very important, especially for women, to do this. Or else you're going to be chasing money the rest of your career.
Let's talk about the strategy. Let's roll it out.
Sure. So in my opinion, there are four conditions that will tell you whether or not you have the power to negotiate your salary. The first one is you're very qualified for the position. Second, they're very interested in you. Three, you don't need the job. And four, you're not asking for that much more. You don't have to have all of those. I think if you have two of them, it's a gamble. If you have three out of the four, then you have a much better chance of doing this. And the reasons is, for the first one, you're very qualified. That's obvious. I mean, I think particularly a lot of women, they won't apply for jobs unless they check off every box that's listed in the job description. I think a lot of us who got a job and then look back at the job description of everything they said they wanted, we're like, oh, wait, this what we do now doesn't really match what they said.
You're a liberal arts poli sci major and you're working for tech companies.
Yes. And it's honestly, when you're saying that, I'm like, who am I to even do that? Like, what's wrong with me? Why would I even put myself out there like that? Of course, I don't belong here. Of course, I don't belong to be here. But you got to put yourself out there. If you want to change your life, you can't be like, oh, well, I didn't make the right decision when I was 18. So I'm just going to give up. I mean, you have to put yourself out there.
I love
and
that.
Then make sure you catch up later on.
I love that criteria. You're absolutely right. You know, I think all of us at some point said, oh, I want to ask for a raise, but I don't want them to fire me. It is not ask for a raise or get fired. Like, that is a false dichotomy. My understanding, as you get better at this, you realize that the worst they can say is no, at which point you have options on your side, right?
Right. In my opinion, I don't think it's best to ask for a raise, especially a large raise within your current role. Because one thing, especially having been a manager, when someone comes to you and 6 months ago, they accepted a job at a certain amount of money. And then all of a sudden, 6 months later, they think the job pays like 15K more. And you're like, well, what? Like, this job doesn't pay that much more. You just accepted this. For me, having been in both sides of the equation there, I think people who think they're going to make more money in their current job, if you're being severely underpaid, then yes. But the average person, you got to go by what the market dictates. And it's a lot easier to kind of reset back to market value when you're in a different role or you're in a different position. So I would actually encourage people to say, is my job or my scope of responsibility that much different from when I started out? And is it the role that I don't like and I want a different role and then I want an opportunity to reset with a salary negotiation there? Or do I want to stick it out in my current role but know that there's a certain limit to how much you're going to get? And companies are very weird about giving off-cycle raises and things like that. It's just a harder battle to fight.
There's one more question I want to ask of you specifically because you're on both sides of this as a manager and as an employee looking to optimize their salary. So how do you go about researching fair salary? And in particular, how close do you come with flirting with that line with trying to figure out what your coworkers are making?
Yep. So I think Glassdoor is awesome. And in the places that I've worked, it's been pretty accurate when I've taken a look at my salary and looked at what it was listed there. It's a great start. The second thing, do you have an in, like somebody who can tell you what the position pays? So for example, my very first job out of college, the legal assistant job, the woman that I actually would have been replacing, she was moving on to law school. In the interview, somehow we connected so well. And she was like, hey, I just want to let you know, they are bringing on an intern to make, you know, $20 an hour and I only make 18. Make sure that you ask for 20. She gave me that information. I was like, oh my God, thank you. Because I never would have known it was okay to even ask that. Who can be that person who can tell you, hey, this is what we get paid, or just so you know, like the pay change and you should do it. If there's a way that you can get an in through someone that way, then that's great. I don't actually believe that sharing information among colleagues, I mean, it's a great way for pay transparency. And I'm especially just being someone who's a huge advocate for women in their careers. I'm very supportive of pay transparency, but at the same time, I don't know if that's the best way to do it with a coworker. Like, is there someone maybe who is in the role but in a different department who can give you a sense or who can give you at least the scales? Like, sometimes managers have access to the pay scales and you can say, oh, okay, well, if I'm a middle of the road person or I'm newer, I'm an entry level, this is kind of the bracket that I'm working with.
That sounds very reasonable. And I completely agree with your take on that. It kind of mirrors my own kind of philosophy. Glassdoor is brilliant. And especially since it allows you to target not only employers, but also specific geographic locations, it really does give you some good access. But I love this idea of you do need to know what is fair compensation for this.
But Jay, so many people have limiting beliefs, right? They sit in their job, they're making that $33,000 in their first job. And sure, they might see that another career, another profession, another role, whatever it may be, offers a $70,000 salary or $100K salary, but they don't know how to get from here to there. And I'm curious your mentality from saying, okay, that's a job I can do, even though I have a poli sci major and I'm in this entry level job. How did you get from here to there mentally more than anything?
Sure. I think I have always been someone who thinks that I can do it. Like, oh, I can probably figure that out. There's not much that I do that I try to have the mindset where I'm like, I can do this. Because as soon as I feel like I can't do something and defeated, I mean, it's a self-limiting belief. I'm just done. So I think for me, I stuck my neck out and I put myself out there for jobs that maybe at first I didn't have every single qualification there. But then I had to make sure that when I was in that job, I caught up and that got my confidence back to perform to the level that I was expected in that role. So for me, I started getting my master's online in information systems. And that was something that no one recommended that to me, but I realized if I want to continue to move up here, I need to have some street cred. And I'm working with engineers on a daily basis. I need to have those fundamental concepts down pat so I can be more effective in my role. So I ended up looking up my work's tuition reimbursement policy and then maximizing that every single year and then taking advantage of some hacks so I can get it paid for as much as possible. At this point in my career, I want to make it clear that I went very fast up the food chain, up the salary chain, all of that. Now I'm at the point that I'm optimizing for happiness. I wouldn't say I'm so close to fire that that's why, but I want to be happy every day. I don't want to just want to jump ship for money. And by staying in my current company, which I love and I have flexibility with and I'm doing well and I really like the people, it's worth way more than me to jump for an extra, you know, whatever amount of money they offer me.
Let's talk about the statement. So you said, I'm no longer optimizing for money at this point. I'm optimizing for happiness. That's an incredibly fi statement right there. You're career focused, you're career driven, you're clearly crushing it at every level. Walk us through your light bulb moment with regards to financial independence.
I read Mr. Money Mustache's blog, and truthfully, the fi concept did not sink in right away. I actually recommended the blog to a coworker and was shocked a year later when he told me he was 4 years away from his retirement date. Because it wasn't something that I read and immediately thought, you know, I know a lot of people, it blows their mind. I didn't have that quite reaction to it. And as someone who's so career driven, it didn't quite make sense to me, to be honest. But then when I heard from the coworker that he was just crushing it, I realized it's not about retiring early. You can still love your job. You can still want to get ahead in your career and, you know, be the CEO of a company if you want to get all the way to the top. But having the option to do something else, having the money and the support and the safety net that FI gives you, it just takes the pressure away. So your career can be, you know, you can, if I want to do something different tomorrow, or, you know, I want to take a job that doesn't pay as well or whatever, I can do that because I have the safety net that FI has enabled me to do. And I just think about things totally differently now.
Just real quick. So that coworker that you turned them on to Mr. Money Mustache, and then they're 4 years away from FI. Was this someone who just took action right away, or was he already saving? Was he already on the path, but without knowing it? Talk me through that, because that's really interesting to me.
He was already on the path, and it signaled to me that he would like this blog because he was someone that he had paid off his student loan debt very early. He was a saver. He didn't like to spend very much money on clothes. And at the time, I think I went away on a work trip with him and another coworker, and she was kind of joking, ragging on him a little bit with some of his views on this stuff. And I said, you know what you sound like? You remind me of this blog, Mr. Money Mustache. I think you would really like it. Then a year later, he stopped by my cubicle. He's like, hey, remember that blog? You know, I'm 4 years out. But we were all mid-20s at the time, and he calculated 4 years out based on him living by himself with him his entire life. And I think, you know, I caught up with him a little bit ago, and things have changed. You know, he has a significant other now. He has different plans for a family and a future. And I think it's different now. So
no, it's like Travis's story that from student loan planner, the failed early retirement.
Yes, exactly. Right. I mean, and then you can recalculate your fine number a million times. I mean, once you put it down, you're not set. No one's going to hold it against you.
So where was your financial life at this point? Finding Mr. Money Mustache, did that have any type of immediate impact at all? Talk us through where you are at this point in your life.
I'm crushing it in my career. I have this incredible sponsor who's opening up opportunities for me, letting me manage a team. I got a really high salary for my age. And, you know, I told you some of my struggles with getting a job out of college. So I have felt like I made it. And I had student loans, but because I made money, I didn't quite connect the fact that I was doing anything wrong or I should be saving more money or anything like that. I think I put 4% into my 401k and I called it a day. But slowly, I started becoming more interested in the movement, especially after hearing that my coworker had this great success with it. And I saw online that Mr. Money Mustache was going to this Ecuador Chautauqua thing. I've always wanted to go to Ecuador, but I kind of needed a group to kind of push me. And for some reason, I just did something crazy. And I said, you know what? It's already closed. So let me just email the organizer to see if maybe there's a wait list or there's an extra spot available. I lucked out. There were two spots. I brought my husband, he was my boyfriend at the time. And the two of us just flew down to Ecuador to meet people that we never really met before. And I didn't even know if it was a real thing, to be honest. I thought it was just kind of weird and, you know, something I would do, I guess, because I do things like this. But it ended up being an incredible experience. And the people we met that week truly affected us. And they launched this entire fire journey.
So let's talk about the fire journey, because on your end, there's so much more tied to this. I mean, I know that while it's actually incredible, and we'd kind of have to pick which way we want to go with this story, but we've spent a lot of time talking about the career hacking. I know that on top of that, you are a voracious side hustler and you have your own kind of resume there. And then on top of that, you built this podcast that have blown up. Is there any sort of linear fashion in which all of these things start to land? How do you go from meeting Mr. Money Mustache and hanging out with the crew in Chautauqua to where you are now?
So I went to Chautauqua. I met Mr. Money Mustache, but more so the week that I was there. I got to know Brandon from The Mad Scientist, Jeremy from Go Curry Cracker, and Jim from Jim Collins and H Blogs very well, because it was a small group. And I also think that everyone kind of not took pity on us, but everyone helped us out, because they saw these, you know, two 20 somethings who just didn't know what they were doing. And the FI community is so nice. They'll just offer advice to you. And if you're open to it, I just sucked up all that like a sponge. So I left that trip thinking, what am I doing? I have the ability to turn all this around. I'm extremely lucky and fortunate that I have this awesome job that gives me the ability to do that. And I'm glad for the work that I had put in previously to get that job. So we started moving, paying off my student loans first, paid off my student loans. Then my husband still had student loans. And a lot of people, they feel weird about paying off their spouse's student loans. And we weren't even married at the time, but I was just on a mission. We wanted those things gone. So we paid off those. I ended up getting a great job in California. I flew out there. That hugely accelerated our path to FI. We had to downsize though. And we had a house in Colorado that was just way too big for two 20 somethings. I don't know why. I think I just got really swept up in it all. I had a Subaru that I had just bought, completely new, sold the car, changed our whole lifestyle based on meeting these people in Ecuador, because I saw how they lived and I realized, you know, I want to live like that. I want to have the option to do whatever life takes me. Even though I'm happy with my life now, I want to give myself options and I have to take these radical changes to do it.
So Jay, before you get on this plane to Ecuador, you're saving 4% in your 401k, and it sounds like that's mostly about it. Then you come back and now you're paying down your student loans, you're paying down Doug's student loans and just crushing this. Not to ask a really kind of oddball question, but like, where did the money come from? What were you spending it on 2 weeks before Ecuador that once you got back, you all of a sudden weren't? Like, what did you actually cut? Because presumably this money was getting spent on something. What did you cut to make these changes to be able to pay down the student loans so aggressively?
Well, part of it, I didn't have that high salary for very long necessarily. I mean, I got this great job and then this is all in a matter of just a few years. So I had maybe had it for a year or something. I got the car. So the car payment was $387 a month, but I determined that it cost me about $700 a month, technically, when you consider how much I drove and when you consider the registration fees and insurance and all that. So selling my car, even though I took a huge hit on it when I sold it, because having a car for 15 months, I mean, it depreciates like crazy. It just kind of stopped the bleed there. And then we rented out our house. We tried to sell it, but we ended up renting it out. And then we moved into a smaller apartment. I switched to a different job. I was working at a financial services company. Then I started working at a tech company. And with tech, especially living in Silicon Valley, if you move to the Mecca of tech, they will reward you very well financially there. And I mean, Silicon Valley, truthfully, we didn't stay there very long because it just wasn't the right fit for us. It was extremely hard to move from Colorado, which is the most amazing state on the planet. I mean, we loved living there, to the heart of it all in California. I mean, it was great from a tech perspective and a career perspective, but, you know, squished into this little apartment, we were paying something crazy, like $2,600 a month to live there. And it was very hard.
I think $2,600 a month is probably on the low end of what people pay in that area.
It was the low end. And truthfully, you know, part of this is that I married my best friend and he's amazing. And I, how our relationship works. I mean, he is the biohacker and I am the career hacker and the money hacker. So I've always pushed him, like, do what you love. And he's found a career that he loves. But when we moved to California, I mean, he had to leave his job, and then it kind of forced him to have to start over again. And at the time, he wasn't able to find work that was quite as consistent as what he previously had. And from a breadwinner perspective, I didn't want to put us in a situation where, you know, if something happened to me or I lost my job, we couldn't afford to live in Silicon Valley anymore. So that was another thing. Like, if we wanted to live comfortably, it put tons of pressure on me to be sure that I could provide every month. And I mean, that totally freaked me out. So we didn't last there necessarily long. And I love where we live now.
And now, is this where the side hustles come in? Is it because you didn't want to rely on just that one income? Is that where this plays into your life, I guess?
I think it kind of does. I mean, I really don't like relying on one source of income. And it makes me happier in my job when I know that I have these other sources of income. When I know, oh, if I lost my job tomorrow, doesn't matter. I could start over because I have these little streams of income all over the place. Part of it is that I like it. It's fun. We've had some incredible people who come on the podcast that when they tell us their stories, Gwen, my podcast co-host, we look at each other and we're like, hey, we could do that. Let's do it. So we've been starting some side hustles based on that. But I think it really comes back to, you know, they say the average millionaire has seven sources of income. I want to be that person that has seven sources of income. I don't want to be relying on one thing ever.
So you got the podcast right now, and you have the Etsy store, and you have your main gig. Anything else?
Well, I have sold on Craigslist in the past, but I haven't done that so much recently. But yeah, it's been really the blog. It's been very successful. I mean, last year I made over $20,000 on the side.
Oh yeah. And the blog. So podcast, blog, Etsy store, and then your W-2. So you're 4 out of 7 currently.
Yes. And technically we rented out our house in Colorado, so we have rental income, but we're trying to sell it this summer. And then I want to get Airbnbs.
Oh man. Yeah. You're touching the box on 5 out of 7. You're so close. You've almost got the game beat. It's incredible.
I know. I get so inspired by everyone in this community. And I think a lot of people would say it's smarter to double down on what you have. This, you know, I have a great W-2 job. I should focus on that. But part of me, you know, from a risk perspective, I like having multiple streams of income, but now it's just who I am now. I mean, I find this fun and I've learned so much. And I think what I've learned on the side in these side hustles has helped me in my day job, because I am now a small business entrepreneur. And if you can optimize something at a really small level, it makes, when you're optimizing something for a big company, it gives you that kind of micro perspective that you would have missed previously.
Yeah. I mean, that certainly sounds like the talent stack that we're constantly talking about here on the podcast, where just becoming a more varied person, learning new skills and information. And it really does touch on every little aspect of your life. And you can't envision where it's going to take you sometimes, but that it makes you a more valuable person. It's neat to see that you've actually seen that, like, at your day job, because that was going to be my next question, was, with all these side hustles, how do you feel that it's impacted your day job positively or negatively, and also your desire to be there?
When I made this last move, I picked a job that I was genuinely interested in. And part of that is it's not necessarily related to what I do on the side at all, but there is a clear crossover, and that was important. I had to be fully 100% interested in what I do during the day to be happy. And I am. But I think the biggest takeaways is that I am super efficient now. I am a very productive person. Having all this stuff going on has made me productive. I can't goof around. I can't surf the web aimlessly. I can't do any of that. I don't have the time for it. So it has taught me to just bang out, whether it's, you know, a website, a podcast episode, whether it's something at work, I can focus, and I've honed those focus skills, and outsourcing too, and scaling. Those are things that I wouldn't necessarily say I struggled with in my job, but now that I have experience from all these outside things where I've outsourced stuff, I've figured out how to scale, how to move faster. Those are things that I bring to my day job that make me better.
Let's talk about optimizing for happiness. So there's kind of a contrast here. So you could optimize for income. And if your W-2 job, if that's the 80-20, if you're making most of your income from that, you could just work more hours, you work harder, you could do more career hacking and continue to go up the corporate ladder. Or you could optimize for happiness, which kind of, you know, maybe you're selecting for a specific location, or you're selecting for location independence. Like, practically of that kind of a la carte menu, what does optimizing for happiness with your W-2 income job, what does that look like?
So the first thing, when I was looking for a job, I wanted a job at a tech company that had flexibility. One thing that I've noticed from working at a more traditional Fortune 500 company to a tech company, the tech companies I've worked at, they're a little bit more flexible. So the hours, while not every place is like this, it's not quite an 8 to 5:30 or 8 to 6 the same way that other companies will be. So what that means is, you know, if you want to come in at 9, 9:30 one day because you want to go to the gym in the morning, or at 2, you don't feel very productive at your desk, you can pick up your computer and go to another part on campus and do work for an hour and a half. Nobody is watching you. And that was a huge thing for me. I didn't want to have the type of job where the person sitting next to you is judging you like, well, where'd you just go for the last hour or something like that. And I think people who are in jobs like that can totally relate. It's just the worst. We're all trying to do the best job we can at our day job. And the extra pressure of feeling like you're being watched is something that I did not like. So what I've noticed is that some companies have a lot more flexibility with that. And as long as you're productive and you're results driven and you get the job done, then they will allow you to have some more flexibility with office presence, at least.
This is ultimately the final straw for Brad. This is why he went rogue and went full on entrepreneur, was that lack of flexibility, right, Brad?
Yeah, that really did hit home. It was just one of those kind of arbitrary rules, like you're describing, Jay, where the person next to you is watching what time you get into the office. And there was just this random change that all of a sudden the work day started a half hour earlier. And it was basically just a screw you type moment. They said, you have to come in, you're not getting paid anymore. It's just, doesn't matter what your work output is. It's just, that's the rules. And I basically said, the F you and the F you money. And I kind of left. It's amazing that there are still companies that operate on that level, because what should matter is your work output.
Yeah. And there are a lot of companies that are focusing on the flexibility right now. So that's great. I mean, I think before, when I didn't realize this type of company was out there, I was stressed out about having a corporate job. But now what I've realized is the corporate job is not keeping me from doing anything. It's in fact making me better. I mean, I talked about how the side hustles make me better. The corporate job makes me better at my side hustles. I can just tell, I mean, how I'm able to operate with the blog and the podcast. I didn't necessarily learn, I've been doing this for a while, but I learned that in my day job. So there's this kind of crossover where I'm learning skills in both direction, and I don't feel stressed out because I found a job that they really value me, that I'm doing a great job for them, and I'm learning tons. And I don't feel like I'm trapped at all. And everything I want to do in my life, I mean, I go to the gym every day. I have time to spend with my husband and my dog. Recently, I took away the one blocker that was making me a little bit stressed out about my job, which was the work remote policy. And that's been a huge relief.
So tell us more about that. What are you now allowed to do? And do you have to, can you work remote full time?
So the biggest stressor for me with this whole FI journey, I lived in Colorado, I lived in California, now I'm living in Washington, and my family lives on the East Coast. And then I married someone whose family's in the Midwest. So, you know, we get 2 weeks of vacation a year. We are spending those 2 weeks visiting family. And after doing that for 6 years, you get tired. You want to take a vacation, just the two of you, and just relax and not do anything. And we're not able to do that. And I really miss my family, and I miss his family. And we have these wonderful people and friends back home that we want to spend more time with. So it makes it kind of stressful. And I worry, you know, am I choosing FI over being with family? Am I choosing to work these great high income jobs because I know it'll get me faster to FI, and I'm missing opportunities that I'll never get back with aging parents or grandparents or things like that. So someone at work started the conversation about working remote, and I decided this was my opportunity. My boss had previously, he wasn't very open to us working remote or working at home, but I kind of put together this proposal with my other coworkers. And before, I never would have done this, especially I have had management experience, and I didn't want my boss to feel like we were trying to like do a mutiny or something over him, because he's fantastic and we all love working for him. But we put together a proposal of the different scenarios that we wanted to work remote or work from home. And there were things like working out of another office so that we could visit family, or working remote one day when, you know, we're traveling, maybe we're traveling internationally. Can we work at another office internationally? Because it makes more sense than being in the office. He approved it. So my biggest blocker, which was feeling guilty about visiting family, I can work out of the office where my family is, where my husband's family is, wherever we want, whenever we want to. So that to me just kind of opened my mind. And I never would have asked for that if I didn't have financial security from FI, if I didn't have these side hustles that I knew I could hopefully grow to a full-time income if I needed to, it kind of gave me the confidence to do that. And now, you know, I don't see my full-time job. I love it. It's fantastic. And I can see myself having a long career there.
You know, it's interesting. This is something that Brad has highlighted. It's not just job or no job. Can you select the parts of it that aren't working for you and remove those? And so much easier when you have that FU money, when you have that financial runway, because you're not worried about how you're going to keep the lights on. You can make a choice or a decision or hold the line on something that really does, you know, have value for you. And this story is, you know, I think it's so actionable and it's so inspiring for someone that may just feel trapped. And I'm sure that you're going to have people listening to this and say, that is me, and I'm still stuck and I'm trying to figure it out. And this just showed me some possible options. So, you know, on their behalf, I want to thank you for sharing your story. And also, you know, for people that want to connect with you, connect with your podcast, what is the best way for someone to find the work that you've been doing and reach out to you?
Go to firedrillpodcast.com or search for Fire Drill Podcast in iTunes.
All right. Now, on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, Jay, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Jay, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
I'm going to give a shout out for my best buddy, Gwen from Fiery Millennials. Nice. I love Gwen. She's hilarious. And one of my favorite things about her blog, she definitely has a more diary type blog where you can go back to the beginning of her fire journey and read every single post, and it all builds upon each other. I love that style of blog.
Yeah, we love Gwen here. She was a prior guest on the podcast and met her a bunch of times in person. I'm curious, like, where did you guys meet? I mean, you're co-hosts together. Like, how did that come together?
We both went to the Chautauqua, but we went different weeks. And I was searching for Chautauqua recap posts, and I found her blog. And at the time, it seemed very rare that someone else who was young was writing about this and was into this, and especially another young woman who worked in tech. So we Skyped, and then it was the start of a wonderful friendship. And then last year, I said, hey, you know what? There aren't necessarily many women fire podcasters out there. Let's start a podcast. And that's helped grow our friendship even more.
You guys are blowing up and doing a fabulous job. I guess we'll go ahead and transition right into question number two, your favorite article of all time. Now, this can be one that you wrote or somebody else's.
The shockingly simple math behind early retirement. I know everyone chooses that, but there's no clearer way to present how possible it is to retire early than that post, in my opinion.
I know, it's just so simple.
So simple, so clear.
It's low-hanging fruit.
Too easy, Jonathan. Too easy. Yeah, that is a tried and true favorite and one that everyone should read unquestionably. All right, Jay, question number three, your favorite life hack?
Ooh, that's a hard one. We talked about the take action life hack. So I guess what I would say is approach things with an abundance mentality, not a scarcity mentality. Originally, when I was pursuing FI, I thought, there's only space to worry about me getting to FI. What I've realized is the more that I give to others and think that, you know what, I have enough for myself and I'm resourceful. I know how to make money. There's more money coming to me, and to kind of be more generous with that, it's helped me so much. So an example, you know, I talked about the student loans, how my husband and I were just dating and I said, you know what, I'm going to help him pay off these student loans. Or similarly with my parents, I found out that they had Parent Plus loans. I think in this community, we can get very obsessed with our net worth and our money. And if you're not going to help the people that you love and make their lives better and use what you have to improve the financial situation of others around you and the knowledge we have, then, you know, what are we really doing this for? So for me, it's approaching things with an abundance mentality. And I think it's opened up a lot of doors for me.
Question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
I think when I first got that big job, my husband and I were so excited, and we bought the most, I wouldn't say it was the maximum that we could have got from the bank, but it was pretty high up there. And we had no business at the time buying our dream home. And also then I went and I bought a new car, and then I got a wonderful dog who is the love of our pup life. But doing those three things in the span of 6 months, I think we really lost it. So that, I would say, is our biggest financial mistake. And it took us a little while to unwind from that.
But the dog was definitely not a life mistake.
No, he's our best friend. We love him so much. I'm surprised he hasn't made an appearance during this episode. I'm glad.
He's got a couple minutes left.
Yes.
All right, Jay. Question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
I think I would tell my younger self to just not put so much pressure on yourself and to try to get to the highest level possible. Because, I mean, life is not a race. And I am definitely someone who wants to optimize everything to get to the quickest path possible. I want to rise up the food chain at work. I want to make these side hustles profitable. I want to have the most trafficked blog and podcast and all of that. But lately, I've realized that it doesn't really matter whether I get to a point now or 5 years from now. It doesn't. So I've had to really reevaluate on that and step back. And it's something that I'm working on.
All right. Now, we do have a bonus question for you. And a lot of our show spends time talking about things that you don't buy, you know, kind of saving that money and putting it towards building that perpetual money-making machine. But ultimately, all of us do make purchases based on value. And so the question is, what is one thing that you purchased over the past 12 months that is bringing the most value to your life?
I have a Panda planner. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but essentially it's a gratitude journal and daily planner that I have. My husband has one. And then we also gifted one to my sister that she uses too. And every day you write down the three things that you're grateful for, the three things you're excited about, your schedule for the day, and then the tasks that you want to accomplish for that day. And there's a calendar section and things like that. So it has a lot of utility in terms of planning your life. But just starting every day with those three pieces of gratitude, it makes a huge difference. And I've never been someone who's been into it. My husband, he's into like meditating and he's into the Headspace app and he's a really fit person. So he's into all that stuff. I didn't really believe it, but I can say that I'm in a better mood when I do that every single morning. I have my coffee and I do my gratitude and it makes a huge difference on my outlook.
Wow, that's really cool. I've never heard of Panda Planner before, but I just Googled it and I'm going to take a look. So it sounds like a cross between the 5-minute journal and like an actual calendar or scheduler, right? That's how you're using it also on an ongoing basis, not just those few minutes in the morning, right?
Yes, exactly. And it really has you focus on your priorities for the day and what are the tasks that I actually have to do. And I noticed when I first started using it, I would put tasks that I didn't have to do or I just would fill it up with things that just, it wasn't reasonable for me to accomplish. And now I'm just getting much better at it. And it all comes back to how can I be really productive and focused because I have all this going on. And part of that is that every day I say, okay, what are the actual three things that I have to do today, both at work and in my entrepreneurial stuff and in my personal life? And it just gets me super focused.
Jay, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been a blast.
Thank you guys for having me.
Brad, Jay's story is a story of triumph, and it is one that so many college graduates have, this moment of deflation when you realize that all of your hopes and dreams were pinned on that bachelor's degree. You've been told and marketed to that the bachelor's degree was going to solve everything, and as you were getting out, you realized that it's not sufficient all by itself. It requires a strategy. It requires intentionality. I think in many cases, many graduates realize that and then just settle and then just never do anything else. They don't realize that, you know, this career advancement, it's not necessarily a linear path forward. It's, what does she call it? A jungle gym, right? And I love seeing proof of concept. I love the fact that she laid her vulnerabilities out there and then showed us how she was able to succeed in spite of all of that.
Yeah. And this is such a story of skill stacking. It really is. I mean, she just picked up a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of information by starting her own blog, working at that travel company, going to these hackathons. I mean, just like all these little things. And it's this amazing story of triumph. It's easy to look at her today and say, oh, she's at a tech company. She's got this great position managing people and making a boatload of money. But it wasn't that long ago. She was working for $9 an hour. Picture that arc. She was a college athlete at a top tier university, had all the internships, had everything right, the grades, et cetera, et cetera. And then she had to start from the very bottom, making $9 an hour after jumping careers. That's what's such a fascinating story. She was willing to do this and she didn't just give up. She doubled down and said, hey, I need to make a success. So what can I do? I can start a gifted and talented program. I can do this. I can do that. it's a wonderful story. I was just so blown away, impressed. And big thank you to Jay for coming on and telling her story.
If you got value from today's episode, if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, take 1 second. Just press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. It just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us in what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.